The Guardian.
Welcome to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper. But who knows? Maybe. Underneath this shirt, there's the crest of Superman. Even just saying that, I sound deranged. And yet this week we learned that Donald Trump actually wanted to do that for real. He told aides he wanted to emerge from his stay in hospital looking frail and weak, only then to rip off his shirt and reveal the giant S of the great superhero. Where do you even start? And yet, that wasn't even the most striking development of the week. Let me tell you about a tweet that leapt right out at me. It came from Ben Rhodes, who's the former Deputy National Security Advisor under President Obama. And it said, "I'm old enough to remember when Boris Johnson said Obama opposed Brexit because he was Kenyan." That tweet from Ben Rhodes was in response to a story by the Sunday Times in the UK, the headline of which read, "Panicking Number 10 Dumps Trump and Woos Biden." Now, by now, you will know the golden rule of this podcast. No predictions, no assumptions, and we would give the same advice to number 10 Downing Street. But that story suggests they're concluding that Trump is finished and it's time to cozy up to his Democratic rival, which got me pondering this week's question. How will the US election affect America's relationship with the rest of the world? How will leaders who've enjoyed Trump's approach to international diplomacy adapt if Joe Biden takes office? And for American allies who failed to warm to the president, to put it mildly, could another 4 years of Trump take ties that have already been frayed and snap them all together? Here to help me get to the bottom of all of that is my fellow Guardian columnist and good friend, Raphael Baer. Raphael, lovely to have you on the show. Less than 3 weeks to go. But given how long these campaigns go on for and how much psychodrama there's been, it does seem almost never-ending, doesn't it?
Well, it feels particularly intense, I think, because, as you just said, so much is at stake. And journalistically, it's very hard to disentangle anticipation of the contest from the sort of undertow of dread about, you know, that nauseating feeling of expectation about what actually might happen. And of course, we've got the memory of, I think it was 2000, Gore Bush, where there wasn't even a decisive result, and overlaid on that, the prospect that Donald Trump, if he appears to have lost the election, will not simply concede. So we don't think polling day is going to give us some great cathartic moment of completion of the Trump era. Even if he loses, there will be some awful odyssey of continuation up to and including real civil strife. So I think there's that element of it that just makes it feel like we're scanning the horizon, anticipating a hellscape.
So we're sticking very religiously, obviously, to making no predictions, but it does sound as if number 10 is in a slightly different place now and preparing for Trump to lose. I mean, you're a Westminster-based columnist. You're down there. You talk to people all the time. Are you picking that up too, that that's what they're now thinking? And if they are, do you know when they started thinking it?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that they are obsessed with data in number 10, and we'll be looking at the polls and judging that just in terms of a balance of probabilities. There is another factor, which really comes down to actually a schism in the character and the personality of Boris Johnson, which is that at one level, he has this Trumpian mode, which is in a little bit in tension with, as it were, the pre-2016 Mayor of London Boris character, who was a much more liberal, centre-tilting, almost sort of David Cameron-style Tory, who won't feel a great particular sort of cultural or temperamental affinity for Donald Trump. But a very crucial thing that actually happened on a practical level was in, I think it was February of this year. So very early on, when Boris Johnson had just won the election, hadn't been prime minister for that long, and had made a strategic unilateral decision pretty much for a country to allow Huawei, the Chinese telecoms company, a fair amount of access to the UK's, what will be the UK's 5G telecoms network. And that's important because a lot of people consider that essentially a security hazard. And what appears to have happened is that the Americans didn't like this, and that Trump himself got on the phone to Boris Johnson. And these two, there had been some affinity, and Trump had said very kind things about Boris. And Trump had a proper tantrum.
"We convinced many countries
And I did this myself for the most part, not to use Huawei.
And, you know, apoplectic was one word that was used in relation to this. And I think that that properly shook them in number 10.
So to be clear, from the end of this year, telecoms operators must not buy any 5G equipment from Huawei.
And once they ended up doing a U-turn on the Huawei thing. So I sense certainly, you know, between February and July, when they did that U-turn, there was a feeling that actually, even if Trump is sort of culturally aligned with the whole Brexit thing and sort of his box office from a pro-Brexit point of view, actually as a partner, he is a pain in the backside. And in particular, when it comes to doing a trade deal, it just became clear that he wasn't really going to deliver. It was just going to be much more psychodrama and performance and fireworks than actual negotiation. And so I sense that will have tilted the mood a little bit.
That's very interesting. So on some level, they'll feel relieved, actually, to have, and I think you do pick this up, and we're going to talk about this later, around the world, the sense that a President Biden would be just such a relief because it would be normal in the sense of what diplomats and others are used to dealing with. But you would have thought one place that didn't feel that would have been the Boris Johnson Downing Street because of this Brexit sort of populist rapport. But you're saying in some ways, actually, even they, the Trump thing sort of became a bit grating after a while.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that the arc of the Brexit-Trump relationship that started in 2016, you know, there were these sibling moments, these sibling shocks, the referendum and then the Trump election, that seemed to signal a very distinct cultural moment for Western civilization. I mean, we can state it that a lot of expectations about the way the whole world order had operated and the consensus around the liberal democratic mode of doing politics seemed to be unraveling. And that was a very salient mood within the sort of Brexiteer Tory circle. And I think actually now 2020, that looks a little bit overstated, that actually the Trump thing looks just a bit more like a heist. It's sort of high-end kleptocracy. And Brexit, the reality of it, obviously, as a lot of people have said at the time, was never going to be able to live up to what was promised. And it's now this very difficult, tricky, ultimately quite boring trade process that you're having to conduct in the middle of a pandemic. And so that arc is sort of coming to a close. And this is the, you know, 2020 feels like the other bookends that was begun in 2016. And yes, so as you say, I think a bit of relief if Donald Trump isn't in the White House anymore. Even the Downing Street Brexiteers, I think, will feel that to some extent.
And what about on a personal level? I'm thinking back to the days of, for example, Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. We would get briefed all the time about how personally close they were, the rapport between them, their wives got on well. There was all this sort of paraphernalia around the, what we're going to come on to, the special relationship. And I suppose related to that a bit, obviously the United States is the bigger, more powerful partner. But, you know, what does Johnson bring to the table in that dialogue between the two of them? Or is it very one-sided?
Well, taking the last point first, it is very one-sided. It is always very one-sided in the US-UK relationship.
When 70 years ago last month, Winston Churchill first described the special relationship.
Special relationship.
Special relationship.
Special relationship.
Highest level of special. So we start off with special.
I mean, a special relationship is something very much that British diplomats and officials have become increasingly obsessed with, and that American in Washington, there's a feeling that you have to sort of indulge the Brits, and there's always this negotiation, this haggle when leaders from the two countries meet about the way, the terms in which the American side will drop the sort of special relationship bomb into the conversation as a way of saying, yes, this is still a very powerful and potent thing.
I did have to say, I always found this so pathetic. I used to be based in Washington, and the when a British leader would come, exactly as you say, this anguish over, will they say we're truly, deeply, properly special? And it was like sort of teenage girls in the sort of playground about, are you my best friend or just my best friend? You know, and and it was so one-sided because on the other side, the Americans would regard, you know, the relationship with Germany as the special relationship, or they would, when, you know, the Israeli prime minister would visit, they would say special relationship. Even, you know, Ireland, because of the Irish-American connection, would get that phrase used. But for Brits, it was this moment of terrible sort of internal anguish and angst over whether or not we were truly in their affections.
That said, the strategic relationship is important, and the UK security services are actually do punch above their weight in global terms and are the closest to the American ones in terms of basically who's trusted in the spy craft. And that is terribly important. And that sort of ideological coupling that went on, I think, that became very important from sort of 1979-80, when you had the Thatcher-Reagan alignment as the most free market economic sort of leaders driving a new consensus in that department, and very hawkish together in the Cold War. And then the ideological recalibration away from that, represented not quite simultaneously, but in tandem, in the sort of Clinton-Blair third way thing. To the extent that Boris Johnson has a better relationship with Trump than Theresa May, and he definitely, definitely does for reasons that we can discuss, it's because he knows how to flatter the man. He knows, you know, Boris Johnson will say anything to anyone in any audience to be liked. And he's worked out that the way to do that with Donald Trump is just to blow smoke up him and tell him how brilliant he is. And I think that's basically how it works.
Let's move to the scenario that they are perhaps calculating, which is a Biden presidency. That could bring stability and sort of calmness, because he's a kind of normal person, a normal politician. But what would be on Downing Street's mind? What worries might they have? And in my mind particularly is a thing which I think Downing Street previously underestimated, which is how proud Joe Biden is of his Irish roots.
My mother was a proud, proud woman who taught us that, I guess it comes from these Irish roots, that you never bend, you never break. Resilience is critically important.
And normally that might not matter, but in the context of Brexit, that could matter. I mean, explain to us why that is and whether a Biden presidency could be trouble for a Johnson administration.
Well, one of the interesting sort of subplots of Brexit in the sort of geostrategic context has been this real coming of age of independent Irish statecraft around the world. And where this becomes particularly acute, obviously, is the fact that the Irish border became such a flashpoint in the negotiations, and the US is officially a co-sponsor of the Good Friday Agreement. And the perception of how Brexit was just damaging and ruinous, it was an act of kind of vandalism to the Northern Ireland peace process, has been transplanted to Washington in general, but particularly to the Democrats. And so if that's how Biden sees it and sees Brexit, that is going to be a problem for a UK administration. And so, yeah, that I think will have shaken number 10.
Could you imagine him actually going the full way and effectively ditching Britain as an ally and saying, right, I'm siding with Ireland and the EU instead?
One of the most shocking things about the Trump presidency that I think hasn't had as much attention paid to it as maybe ought to have is the way he treats the European Union as this kind of hostile force, which is connected in some ways to sort of trade deficits and imbalances, but also part of a broader contempt for the whole institutional architecture that supported Western liberal democracy.
Yeah, I mean, he was once asked to name his biggest, what he thought America's biggest foe in the world was. And he said,
well, I think we have a lot of foes. I think the European Union is a foe, what they do to us in trade.
The EU. I mean, they'll be watching very closely, obviously, to see if Trump wins. And you know, you've said rightly that Trump himself has been so disparaging about the EU. He called Emmanuel Macron very, very nasty, a term I think he usually reserves for women. But he did say that about Macron. I mean, what would Joe Biden's approach look like, do you think, if there were hypothetically a Biden presidency?
Well, I think it would just be a restoration of normal, sensible diplomatic protocols with regard to what are the US's traditional allies in Europe, because they are democracies and crucially NATO members. I mean, crikey, the idea that Donald Trump came pretty close to just abandoning NATO, which was the absolute cornerstone of transatlantic security for a couple of generations. That said, it is also really important to remember that losing sort of interest in Europe and getting a bit fed up with what was seen as European free riding on American security capability predates Donald Trump. I mean, the Obama administration was sort of pivoting much more to concentrating on Asia. Obama himself had a much more Pacific focus, and some people said partly because of the sort of Hawaiian connection, and just that was the way he looked at the world, and the sense that the obsession with NATO and the transatlantic alliance was a very sort of 20th century East Coast establishment thing. And actually America's longer term view of the way the world was going was always going to end up being much more interested in China. And this rhetoric that, you know, that Trump has taken to extremes and delivers in the most sort of appalling and unpleasant way.
In saying that NATO members must finally contribute their fair share and meet their financial obligations.
Yeah, we don't necessarily like the way that Donald Trump expresses that, but that has been expressed by the whole bipartisan Washington establishment for, you know, since before Donald Trump. That's an issue.
But the country he talks about most, Donald Trump, and I'm interested to know what you think about how this might play, has always been China.
China. China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
And China's going to pay a big price what they've done to this country. China.
I mean, even back to his 2016 campaign, he's doing it still now. He's back to renaming coronavirus China virus. The sort of layperson's assumption would be that will all cool down if Trump goes, and that a Biden presidency would be much less antagonistic towards China. And, you know, obviously we've witnessed these trade wars and this back and forth over tariffs and the rest of it over the last 3-4 years. I mean, is that too actually a misreading? And is this a tension that is itself bipartisan and will endure?
It is, I think, but you have to distinguish between, you know, a strategic judgment about the US's position in the world when you have this new emerging superpower that can actually be a different locus of serious might relative to the US, such as hasn't existed since the collapse of the Soviet Union, alongside the unique, for want of a better word, diplomatic methodology of Donald Trump. Does that mean that he would not essentially see China as more rival and threat than potential ally and friend? I think that rivalry is now baked into the fact of superpower blocks with competing spheres of interest, very, very nationalistic views of the world, a big ocean between them, and lots of flashpoints that can go wrong. So it might be safer with Biden in the White House, but it would not be calmer.
I mean, the tension, in other words, is still there, even if it's handled more sort of, you know, in a more steady way. Let's just talk in our closing minutes about those countries and those leaders, actually, who will be worried about a Trump defeat. And what I'm thinking there is a phrase, it's not mine, I think Yasha Munk coined it, talking about the illiberal international. You could call it the populist international. This kind of fraternity of populist leaders. I'm thinking Viktor Orban in Hungary, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. I think you could put perhaps Vladimir Putin. There's this group of leaders who were playing a similar kind of ultra-nationalist politics, who saw Trump as suggesting their moment was ascendant in the world. They will be presumably worried about a Trump defeat, not necessarily because Trump's not there anymore, but what it means sort of symbolically for this brand of politics.
Yeah, it comes back to a little bit what we were saying before about the arc of Brexit 2016 to 2020. If there is a big Biden win and the Trump thing sort of implodes, the sense of grown-ups being back in the room could be quite strong, because, you know, when Merkel will have survived, still be there. The thing about the idea of an illiberal sort of populist international is there isn't really any coherent institutional basis for that anyway. So Putin, for example, predates this whole phenomenon, and he will do whatever he has to cling on to power. So I don't think that will be substantially changed. And in terms of the sort of East European, the Orban, and the situation in Poland as well, to what extent they are restrained or what their behaviour is, I think is still very much actually, in global terms, a parochial function of the EU. So a lot depends, I think, on whether or not the economics and the coronavirus situation play out in such a way as serious evidence-based rational policy making enjoys a bit of a resurgence, or the rage and the frustration and the anger that could be stoked by an economic crisis in the wake of the coronavirus mean that the appetite for glib, easy solutions, slightly paranoid responses, and the sort of hollowing out of democracy that seems to have happened, whether that just carries on. But certainly not having one of those characters in the White House has to be damaging for that sort of proposition. It has to, if the American Republic is seen to, as it were, rebound and have constitutional order in some way restored, that's got to be good for liberal democracy, right?
I'm honored and humbled to appear before you today as a nominee for Associate Justice of the Supreme Court.
Raf, before we let you go, we always ask on this podcast a what else question. This week, what else is going on? And it is the nomination hearings of a Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, chosen by Donald Trump to fill the seat of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Normally, this would be massive political news. It would be the event of the year. In 2020, it sort of struggles to make it into the inside pages. But if you could look to that at all, and if you have, is your what sense do you get of the notion of Judge Coney Barrett, or Justice Coney Barrett, she'll be?
I'm afraid I just see it very much in that broader context of what we were saying a moment ago, which is a test of whether or not the Trump era has sort of stretched the constitutional order of the US Republic beyond a certain elasticity point, and it just can't ping back, by which I mean, you know, an understanding alongside the letter of the statute and the letter of the Constitution, whether there are basic questions and protocols of decency about the way people uphold the principles of the Republic, whether that could survive, or whether that damage is so severe that we're talking about a different type of republic now, a different type of state. And, you know, the classic example here, I think, was when asked whether or not a president who loses an election should just stand aside.
That seems to me to be pulling me in a little bit into this question of whether the president has said that he would not peacefully leave office. And so, to the extent that this is a political controversy right now, as a judge, I want to stay out of it, and I don't want to express.
You know, and Trump's nominee was not able to just simply say, well, obviously that's what should happen. You lose, you lose. I would say it was jaw-dropping, but you know, my jaw has been dislocated by the sheer force of drop so many times in the last 4 years that I don't have any teeth left. You know, I can't even articulate how depressing that is. But that to me is the context in which I'm following this process.
Raphael Baer, columnist at The Guardian, master of the political metaphor. You gave us dozens to delight in this time. Thanks very much for joining me this week.
Thank you for having me.
Now, if everything goes to plan and there are no more tantrums, you'll be able to hear me and Richard Wolff break down the must-hear moments of next week's debate night. I'll have the coffee on. On Tuesday, 20th of October, you can join me along with Daniel Strauss, Lauren Gambino and Richard Wolff from our Guardian US team for a live stream discussion on the election. And you can find the link for that on today's episode description. And as if that isn't enough, talk about this election. Our flagship daily podcast, Today in Focus, has covered some interesting areas of the election this week, like the problem with voter suppression and what would happen if Donald Trump refuses to leave the White House. So just look for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. And for anyone wanting to hear what Boris Johnson had to contend with at home this week, do make sure to listen to The Guardian's deputy political editor, Jessica Elgott, as she discusses the latest COVID restrictions and Brexit negotiations in this week's episode of Politics Weekly. But for now, it's goodbye. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.